Hey guys, Andrew Johnson of Nylon Calculus and his own fabulous blog, Counting the Baskets, is my guest for this episode. I hope it has the same kind of depth as the usual Ode to Odin episodes, just in a bit of a different way. We get pretty deep in the weeds from a statistical jargon perspective and talk about concepts surrounding single metric statistics, models, particularly his PAWS draft model and his shot projection models, and even some evidence for the interesting upside versus median outcome argument that we've had a few times on this show. I really, really enjoyed this conversation, but I have no idea how well it's going to be received. It seems like every time I try to dumb things down or play to like a wider audience, I end up underestimating the people that listen to this and getting a lot of pushback. So please give me feedback about this episode. I want to do more like it, and I need to know how best to provide this kind of information. All right, this podcast is part of the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. Check out other Almighty Baller podcasts, because right now, almost every one of them is very draft-centric. If you don't already listen to What's on Draft, it's maybe the best draft podcast right now, so definitely go subscribe to that one. I am Sean Darenthal, your host, and this is Ode to Odin, the NBA Draft Podcast. Well, thanks, Andrew, a ton for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. You're definitely the first of your kind to come on. We've had somebody in the past come on who's really great and who's really smart. And who had a draft model, but I'm not sure statistically he's quite at your level. So why don't you just kind of explain your background a little bit, like how you have helped inform basketball fans everywhere through Nylon Calculus and everywhere else that you've written in the past, kind of like what your approach is, what unique skills you bring to basketball.
I don't know how unique they are, but I guess it started about
go with it, Andrew. Just go with it.
three years ago, and was kind of inspired to do the draft model by some of the things I'd seen out there, including Lane Vashro's work when he was doing stuff for Canis Hoopus. And my background is actually as a real estate analyst. And I've been doing modeling, trained models for that for, a number of years. And so I bring a lot of that to this, a lot of that experience in modeling and different stats packages that I used in my sort of day job. But so got into modeling on the draft about 3 years ago, like I said, when I read Lane Vashro stuff, and I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. Let's try my hand at it. And one of the things that I did that was kind of unique at that time was I decided to put the European prospects in there too.
Yeah,
and I had done some work on converting Euro stats over because when I first looked at the draft, I realized that about 20% of the guys that have been drafted in the last 10 years or so. Have been international and primarily coming out of the Euro leagues.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to that. That's something that I have struggled with trying to do my own kind of just basic stuff. I practice a little bit with some of the stuff like as I'm learning, so I don't have anything that's really well fleshed out yet. But yeah, translating international statistics was definitely something that I had to ask a lot about, try to figure out kind of the best way to do that, because that I think can be a little bit tricky, particularly because the sample size seems to just be, I don't know, to me kind of difficult to, obviously problematically small. But let's start at the beginning. Kind of, can you just help? On this podcast, I think that a lot of people that listen are pretty well informed. I have a small audience, but I think they're mostly pretty smart guys. So you don't have to pull any punches here. You can not get too much into the weed, like too much into the jargon, but I think you can explain it at like a pretty deep level. Just, can you talk to us a little bit about looking at the game through statistics, like which is done so much now, kind of the flaws that a lot of people fall into, and kind of what is like the best practice when we're just trying to look at stats and or models or, whatever it is, and trying to interpret that and like extrapolate any conclusions from that about basketball, whether it be the NBA or, projecting these guys to the NBA.
I think probably the primary one, modelers are subject to the same biases that everybody else has, confirmation bias and what have you. And so is being consistent in your approach and being consistent, not, you know, putting your fingers on the scales or picking, I like this statistic for this guy, this statistic for that guy. And I think that's, you know, when you use a draft model or anything else where it's, you know, pick a variable, you know, and I can get into what the variable that I'm using and how you pick it, but you pick the one variable and you train the model on that, and then you test the model on data that hasn't seen, which is a big thing. Is that you can't just say, well, I've trained it to the data I have, and so therefore it works, but then, you know, test on data that wasn't used in it to begin with. Then, you know, you enforce that consistency, and it basically eliminates some of your biases,
right.
And you don't have an opportunity to let those sink in.
Okay, so I want to talk just like a little bit about something that I see a lot and that I've seen a lot recently, and I'll just kind of introduce this topic, and then I'll ask you to kind of weigh in on what your opinion is. So in statistics, there are kind of two larger categories. One is like a summary statistic. So like an average, that's most of your box score statistics, things that we can just add up, or things that are kind of descriptive of here's what happened. This is like an observation, right? Mm-hmm. And then there are inferences where, you know, they come out of a model and that model is trained on a set of data in some way. And some of these models that are trained, there's this dichotomy where if the model is simple in a certain way, and it's more complex than I'm going to kind of go into right now, obviously, and not that I'm like some super expert in this, but there's this trade-off between kind of a simplistic algorithm for deriving your end formula, and mm-hmm. and the interpretability of that formula. So like simple regression models, which is basically like, hey, I need to fit my data. Like I try to get my data to explain like one independent variable. And it can be a little more complicated than that, obviously. But in that way, there's like coefficients that go, you know, if we're just using box score stuff, like assist rate, you know, has like a certain coefficient and they're all relative to the other coefficients. So you can maybe start to interpret like, hey, what does this mean? Like, what should I be evaluating? And then there's some other stuff that I'm starting to get into kind of heavily because of some classes that I'm in now, this machine learning stuff, some of this AI stuff where like neural networks, they're much better predictors. They match like when I just make like a basic model, not even that I really know all the ins and outs of the constraints and all different levels of these neural networks yet. I can definitely match my data. Like it's much, much, much more predictive. But in that case, I don't really know why the algorithm came up like with the prediction that it did. And so there's this trade-off between maybe a simpler model that doesn't fit your data as well, not as predictive, but you can learn something from it, and or being really, really predictive, but not necessarily knowing why. So there could be some things in there that might trip you up, and the greater opportunity of learning kind of about basketball you don't really have in that regard. So maybe you can talk about that just a little bit. I don't know how much you dive into the machine learning stuff, but I think that's really just kind of this interesting debate that I've kind of been going over in my head a little bit. And I obviously we should be probably just using both, but maybe you can kind of just speak to this little dilemma.
Yeah, that's definitely there's a trade-off that you have there. And I have tended to use regression in most of my work because of that, because what I'm really interested in, especially when I first started the draft model, and it's gotten kind of more complex as I've gone on just because I keep messing with it and trying different things.
Yeah.
You know, but what I was first interested in is like, what is the basic relationship between this thing and that thing, and and often that's in my real estate work, that's, you know, actually the answer more than the prediction is how much does this aspect play into it, and so I need kind of some sort of number that, you know, other than like the importance level that you'll get from some of the machine learning things.
Yeah,
like one of the machine learnings that algorithms that I like to use is called a Bayesian machine learning, it's a BART machine. But what you get is a level of importance, but you really kind of don't know, because it's using so many interactions in there.
Andrew, could you explain that just like a little bit more, the Bayesian stuff, just for the audience?
So this Bayesian is based on a random forest or a tree's decision model. But what it does is it sets some priors, and it does it all within the algorithm of setting up priors first and then going through and doing the tree splitting. And then when it comes back out, it tests it against sets aside part of your sample as just the test data, and it'll kind of show you which one did better with the priors or without. And usually what happens is, or almost all the ones I've seen were with the priors, actually it prevents it from overfitting to the data that you're looking at, where which with neural networks and stuff, you can get into a lot of overfitting issues too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So,
I agreed that's a and it really depends on what you want to do. When we talk about like these, say web companies, when they're just trying to find out, recommend a movie for you to watch because you've watched these three movies, they don't really care why you're picking that. Right, they just want to come up with a recommendation but in our case, I think most of the time we want to know why. And maybe within an organization, an NBA organization, they'd be less concerned with that. I don't know. But probably they're going to want you to at least be able to explain why, to some degree, why you're recommending this. That's what the neural network, and I think probably people who really, some of them, the machine learnings, are a little better than others, but right. I don't think I'm quite the expert on that one either.
Yeah, I think you're right. If there is this problem, I didn't think about this aspect. If there is still this problem of communication, it seems to be kind of a bigger and bigger topic, like more so than just like, are stats good or not? Obviously they are, right? We've moved away from that into like, how is it best to communicate stats, especially in the front offices, to coaches who are, kind of statistics illiterate. And if you come to them and you say, hey, here's what this artificial intelligence told me you should do, and he says, why, what's your basis for this? And you say, I have no idea. But obviously you're right. That could be maybe one of the barriers, more so than just, hey, maybe it's right. Maybe like it's the right thing to do. But if you can't say why, if you can't communicate that well, then maybe it's a problem. So let's move on to something. Your single metric statistic, AWS, and then I'm not sure if PAWS is the title of your model, if it's PAWS or if you like pronounce it PAWS or whatever, but your single metric statistic, talk about that just a little bit. What goes into it? Because that I believe is still the dependent variable of your model, right? What you're trying to fit everything to.
Yeah, I've done a number that don't use that, but I've never really pushed those in publication, in part because you get that kind of multiple choice issue where if you publish 10 different models, you can always say, well, this one was right. One of them is going to be kind of more right. You can pick and choose. It's like putting in a bunch of NCAA brackets. If you put in enough, you improve your chance of, finishing in the money, but you've had to buy so many that it doesn't actually pay off.
Right.
So, what I use is the max score that the player gets in years 2, 3, or 4 in the league. So, whatever their best score on the P is for, like, for, I think, potential.
Okay.
AWS. And the reason I use the first 4 years is, one, you get a little bit less extension.
Wait, Andrew, real quick, would you mind backing up and just talking to us a little bit about AWS and, like, what kind of goes into it? Unless it's, a secret. I don't know.
No, it's actually not something that I created. It's a pretty pretty simple linear box score metric. And again, one of the reasons I chose that was because it was simple, and you can kind of see when you're doing the model how they had the same stats in college for that as you do in the pros, whereas some of the other ones, like RPM and such, you actually can't calculate what they were doing in college. You can't see the relationship as easy. And I chose that one because Neil Payne had done a study as that being the most predictive out of sample for teams in terms of predicting who was going to win. And then I took the raw score on the box score metric and then adjusted it based on their playing time.
Okay.
And it's not a kind of a linear adjustment like just total win shares, which is how you did in your win shares per 48 times the minute played. It's non-linear because what I found is a guy who plays 2,000 minutes isn't necessarily or consistently better than a guy who plays 1,000 minutes, which, if you think about it, kind of makes sense in that if you're a coach, you have two shooting guards, and you know, he thinks you're, you know, maybe a 20% better shooting guard than I am, he's not going to play you 20% more. He's probably going to play you two times or three times as much as he does the one. So it's certainly it's an indication. If a guy plays more, it's an indication that he's probably a better player, even if it's not completely picked up in the box score. But I don't think it's quite as linear as I said. If you play twice as much, you're twice a better player because, you know, that's not how the decisions are being made.
Right.
So you know, and the other reason I chose a 4 year window is basically so I could use more data and get guys who are modern. So right now I'm using people drafted through 2002 and 2012.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I first did it. I didn't have the 2012 in because they hadn't played long enough. And if I redo it this year, I'll add the 2013 players to it. You know, and just allows you to kind of go up into that modern NBA. So, you know, when you're looking at 3-point shooting and those kind of things, it's coming into it. And the other reason is, of course, that's, you know, when you draft somebody, you have them for 4 years, and that's when you have your under that great rookie contract.
Right.
And at the end,
it's decision 4 years time, right?
Is when you have to make the decision time, right? Exactly. So
that's interesting that you choose just an individual, like the peak year from 2 through 4. So I've been using the average of their third and fourth BPM.
Mm-hmm.
Because I found that is actually pretty predictive of the 3 year peak over a career. And because I wanted to get, like you said, I wanted to be able to use, just more data, because in college, you know, a lot of the stuff on Basketball Reference only goes back so far. And I wanted to add, you know, an extra like 4 years of guys. Right. I knew that Anthony Davis's peak probably hasn't happened yet or maybe hasn't happened yet. And so if I can just average his third and fourth years, then that's actually fairly predictive of his peak.
If guys, it, you know, third and fourth year, and I think that's, you know, interesting for the, just in terms of when you look at these restricted free agents and things, first year you can kind of give a guy a bye. I mean, obviously, you know, the really great players like LeBron or whatever are that, but yeah, if they kind of haven't figured it out by their third year, most people don't. Most players don't. I'm sure somebody can come up with an example where they did, but it's pretty predictive. Yeah.
Yeah. So I looked at those individually, and they weren't at nearly as predictive. Well, I shouldn't say nearly, but there was like a sizable gap between just an individual year, the second, the third, and the fourth. I didn't even look at the first, honestly. Maybe I should have, but the average of the third and the fourth was a lot more predictive. So why are you just choosing the peak year instead of maybe an average of all three or the average of the third and the fourth?
Yeah, when I looked at it, I found that it was about as predictive.
Actually, Andrew, can I stop you for a second? Just in case, if anybody's lost, we're talking about the statistic that he's trying to fit all of the other like box scores, like all the other data that he's using about these college players. We're talking about the statistic that he's going to use to try to fit all of these to that to create his PAWS model, if I can call it PAWS. I don't know what you call it.
PAWS. Yeah, whatever. That's fine.
So that's where we are right now. He's justifying which exact statistic he's using to kind of extrapolate all this information to make a prediction about where these players will be their second, third, or fourth year or whatever. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if you were testing against, so it's using the max is different than just picking just the third or just the fourth. Or it's about as predictive as, or I believe it was as predictive as averaging them, but you're getting their best one, because you're looking at, if a guy has one down year, it's not as big a deal, because you'll pick that best year that he had, and that's more indicative of his potential.
Yeah, honestly, embarrassingly, I hadn't even thought to just pick the best one. Like, it seemed to me, maybe, I don't know, in hindsight, I'll say that at the time I was thinking that seemed a little bit, I don't know, biased or something like that. At the time, I didn't even think of it. So, but that's a really good point. Obviously, trying to average the two is basically trying to solve the same problem that you talked about, right? Like a down year. But maybe there is something to the fact that a down year, there's more variation in playing kind of below where you are than above, right? Like, so nobody has like a season where they look amazing, but they're really not that good. That seems to be more rare than like there's some circumstance, in the context of their team or maybe their personal life or injuries or whatever.
Injuries, yeah.
Yeah.
Injuries is always way below.
So that's a good point. Maybe I should go back and look at my own numbers and just try max.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll come out that much different, and than the average. You know, a lot of times, when you get into these things, you realize, you're really fighting over kind of scraps in terms of improving your performance. And so, oh, I went from if you say R squared, I went from R squared of 0.41 to 0.415. That's great.
Which is R squared is just the how well your model predicts, like how well the data fits. Yeah. So
the percentage of the variance explained by the model, as opposed to just random guessing.
Right. Okay. So let's get into a little bit of like specific examples about your model. We talked about it. I mean, I don't know if you mentioned. I assume that it's just a regression model. You talked a little bit about using that because it's a little more simple. But since you've said that you've added on components, what are these other components that you've kind of tacked on that have helped your model, and how much have they helped? I assume it's kind of like marginal, but maybe significant.
So the last couple things I did. I averaged, or I included their high school rating in which variability called risky, which now all of a sudden I can't remember what it is.
Right, but RSCI rates, yeah. Go ahead.
It's their average of what they were rated in coming into college, if they were college players.
Right.
And that helped, and especially kind of adjusted down, it lessened the reliance on the age factor.
Hmm.
And also helped pick up some of the potential in guys like say Andrew Wiggins, who had a rough 1 year in college, or Jaylen Brown, who had a terrible one year in college. You know, but had been really highly recruited, and otherwise the model just wasn't picking up any of that information. Though I guess some people have come up with are kind of putting together some of the AAU stats now, but I haven't gotten my hands on those.
So I'm curious, how much does that actually help the model? It seems like a lot of scouts will just say, like,
it's pretty marginal, and it's really only for the top 30 guys that it helps. After that, and so that's a non-linear variable, because it's really guys who are in the top 20 or 30 in their recruiting class that is has some indication for success going forward. But after that, you know, because they rate down to like the 150th best or whatever player, and really they're just throwing darts at that point, I think. When they're talking about the 150th best guy coming out of high school, you know, that doesn't mean anything. But for those top 20, top 30 guys, you know, and especially if you're in like the top five, those guys are worth looking at. So like assists, early on, I made non-linear relatively early on. And that helped out quite a bit because assist is so positional.
Right.
And what I was looking at in the data was that it looked like assists was showing up as more important as an indicator for front court players, you know, guys who weren't, you know, expected to have the ball in their hands. You can get, you know, assist hunting by a point guard, whatever, that's not really helping the team and maybe isn't that indicative of skill, but, you know, or at least there's a diminishing return there.
Right, definitely.
And so that's a non-linear where it's got a diminishing additional assists have diminishing value. So that kind of helped me pick up Nikola Jokic, which I think I had as the fourth or fifth best player in his draft, and you know, he ended up going in the second round, and you know, you can see that. And there's this center who's for his position, he was putting out a lot of assists, and so when you make it as a non-linear variable, it kind of showed up a little bit more.
So are strict positions in your model?
I don't actually have.
Have you tried doing that? Every time I try to do something like that, because I think, like, intuitively that makes a lot of sense, right? Statistics vary, like, on your role, it, you know, like, if we're just eyeballing true shooting percentage or whatever, like, we go to Hoop Math and we're looking at your percentage from different areas of the floor, or we're looking at your turnover percentage or whatever it is, like, it seems, obviously, like, intuitively we kind of couch those statistics in your role, in your position, and it makes sense that that would kind of show up in models as well. But every time I've tried to add that, maybe I'm just not doing it in a sophisticated enough way. Every time I tried to add that information somehow into a model, it like doesn't really change it at all. Like it's not a significant difference.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever explicitly tried position. I used height on and off, but it's never been a major one. When I've done ones with a different variable that includes, regularized, adjusted, plus, minus, then height has come in because it affects on the defensive side. But still, even then, it's not like a, you know, it's maybe explaining like 2 or 3% of the variance.
Interesting. Okay, so I want to ask you one more quick question, and then we should try to plow through like at least some names of guys in this draft so that we pick up some of the audience that maybe isn't loving this stuff, although I love it, and that's why I'm doing this. So it's all right that we've gone this deep, but let's try to pick up some other people in the audience too. But I have one quick question for you. Age, obviously, you talked about already a little bit. Age obviously is a big factor, and you know, a lot of people throw around the fact that it's like the most predictive part of these models is your age. When you go to age adjust all of your statistics, which I'm pretty sure I read that you do. Maybe you do it kind of a different way, but growth rate, so I've been thinking a lot about this, like how much it makes sense. Growth rate is definitely not linear, but I wonder like how it changes for these freshmen, where most of the growth rate that, or at least how I adjust for it, is based on just normal growth rates for like the average player in college, right?
Right.
But I don't know if that's how these freshmen start, these one and done guys, how they actually progress. Like, are they slower than that curve? I can make a good argument that they're slower because they're already so much better that they can't improve that. Like, there's some diminishing returns on the growth that they have afterwards. Or I can make the case that they're better players, so in some ways they're growing faster because maybe their feel is better, or in some ways maybe their bodies develop like more athleticism, and so you know that equals kind of more box stats, you know, later. I don't know.
Right.
They're already at such a high usage, it kind of seems that maybe they wouldn't grow as fast, but then some of these really defensive-oriented guys who don't already have high usage, you could see maybe their growth curve being a lot faster. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, like, how do you account for age? Is it just, you know, based on the average NCAA player? And then, like, what do you think about kind of what I just said? And is there maybe a way that we should try to do this that, like, is there a way to test this, to figure out how star these one-and-done guys are actually growing?
Yeah, the one and done ones are, when I started off, I did exactly what you're talking about. Looked at the average growth guys who were, who stayed in college or whatever, and made that a variable and put it in, and it fit pretty well. But you're right, the one and done guys, you don't really know how they would have done. But the one change that I did do, and this was just the last one that I applied this year, was to treat scoring differently. Because when you break down, if you break down BPM or AWS and look at which stats change for the guys who are in college, and you get the similar results when you look at guys after they enter the NBA, you know, what things improve, assists, rebounds, blocks are not things that really improve that much. They do a little bit, but those are not the big movers. For scoring volume is one that is, I don't know if I can say this right. Scoring volume, so you get a lot more credit now in my model. That one's interactive with age. If you score a lot when you're young, okay, that is a really good indicator. But efficiency is, on the other hand, so a guy who scores a lot when he's a senior, that's not really that impressive. Efficiency is kind of the other way, I guess, so that what it ended up doing in this model, just to kind of take it into guys,
yeah,
is when I changed it, under the original version had Lonzo Ball way ahead of Markelle Fultz, because he barely scores, but when he does, he's just incredibly efficient.
Right.
But what I found is guys who kind of low volume scores when they're young, that's a little bit of a troubling indicator, and that the being a really high volume scorer the way Fultz was actually was a better indicator than what I'd thought. So
I'm glad you used that example, because as you were like describing this principle, I thought, oh wow, I wonder how that affected Ball. Because
basically, when I'd done it originally, I had a big gap and looked like Ball was definitely the better prospect. But now my model has them really about even.
Interesting.
So, it took that whole difference and changed away. And then there's a general age curve, but that was, most of it got eaten away, because the scoring is the biggest factors in the age. And then the other ones are turnovers, young guys just turn the ball over, but they learn to make better decisions as they get older, and fouls too. Foul rates tend to go down, and that's probably more true of big guys, obviously. But for all, you know, those kind of mistake plays, the turnovers and the fouls are ones they learn, they adjust their game more. You know, those are kind of maybe more mental aspects.
Yeah. So am I right in saying that you don't age adjust like all of the box score, or like their AWS? You just throw age in the model, and it comes in like the interaction variables, like in your regression, rather than like having all of the stats that you're throwing into the model be pre-adjusted.
Right. Right. Yeah, so there's an age adjustment, which is the adjustment that, you know, start off as like the adjustment that I would expect based on their college stats over on their age. And then through in the interaction variable with scoring volume and scoring efficiency.
Oh, so it's both.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Cool. All right, so let's get to some of these results. Why don't you tell us just like a little bit about this year's class, maybe some guys that are different than maybe consensus, if you're kind of familiar with that, and then maybe where are some of the gaps? Like, where are the tiers? Where are the chunks of guys that are going to be good? And maybe if you could interpret a little bit about the projection, like if that's right, like an all-star level guy, or, you know, like a role play, like, you know, what that kind of means.
Right. So, you know, definitely D in the model, Ball and Fultz are the first tier, and there's kind of no question about that. One of the things I did, because the numbers are, you know, I can interpret them as plus minus numbers, which maybe are more familiar to some of your listeners, but even for a lot of people, that's not. But then I also take, you know, what the average error in the model is, and then say this guy has a 9, and this guy has a 7.6 or whatever, and how often is the guy with the 7.6 going to be worse than the guy with the 9?
Right.
And so I can run through simulations based on the average error rates. All right, well, you know, in this case, the guy with the 9 is going to be better about 70% of the time.
Okay, I was wondering how you got those percentages. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so you look at it, if I look at, you know, in the past, what's the error rate been out of sample for the model, and then you basically run a simple Monte Carlo simulation, and I only do it 500 times. You could, you know, do as many as you want, but by 500 you get at least good enough to give you an average. It's not going to move too much.
Yeah.
So I got Fultz and Ball, and then the next tier, I would say, you know, when I'm not including the draft board position, because I always do one kind of at the end, right? Include what's their kind of consensus draft board position. Mm-hmm. And that's going to, again, give you a couple bit percentage better prediction. But, you know, before you take that into account, the next, I've got Dennis Smith, Jonathan Isaac, TJ Leaf, and Tony Bradley and Josh Jackson. And obviously Tony Bradley and TJ Leaf are the guys who were loved by the model and have much higher here than I'm sure any of the draft boards have them.
Yeah. Interesting.
And so, you know, with Leaf, you know, his offensive numbers really are fantastic. And the question you obviously have to have is, like, how much credit do you give Ball or that offense that he was in? And then with Bradley, it's kind of interesting that to me that he's not as well liked as the model. It's kind of an interesting case because, in one way, I see it because he's a little bit more of a throwback player.
Yeah.
And he has one, like, elite skill, which is rebounding. He just gobbles up rebounds. But then the thing that kind of makes him interesting to me, sometimes you can see that in a model, say, well, he really is a little one-dimensional. And despite the fact that he's great at this, it's not necessarily a great indicator. But he's not really bad at anything that's at least bad at anything that's picked up by the box score.
Yeah.
So it sort of makes him an interesting. So.
Yeah, that is interesting. He, yeah. Okay. Cool. So I wanted to ask you about, I lost it thinking about Tony Bradley. now I'm going to be thinking about like where I lay on him this whole time. All right. So I wanted to ask you about who is somebody that you, or what have you learned from your model in terms of just like basketball stuff, projecting guys, like what are some lessons that you learned that maybe aren't as intuitive? And then looking at some of your big misses, like where you have guys too high or where guys in your model were too low. Have you learned anything from that pattern, or is that just more or less random?
So some of the ones that I believe that I've learned from, I've incorporated in the model, and that's why I went out and I looked for that high school ranking, the risky.
Yeah.
Because I knew that, you know, if these one and done guys and you've got 1,100 minutes of play, you know, so we talk about a guy having a one bad year, right? You know, so that one bad year might be the only year you have. So I said, well, let's see if these rankings give me anything. And that gave me a little bit. And again, with the scoring volume change to the age adjustment was another one. So I was trying to think about, you know, so I think, you know, I had slow-mo. Pretty high. I think I had him like seventh or so overall. And he did what, 2 years at UCLA. And that's a guy obviously where it's the athleticism issue, right?
Right.
You know, and there's some things about positional fit, which I don't know if those were true or not. You know, he's turned into, you know, a role player, and I don't know if he's got much you know, much more potential than that at this, but you know, you realize that athleticism is something. You know, and I did a model where I took the ratings that NBA draft .net use. They have like a 10-point score for, I think it's 12 different things they rate. And you know, what do you know, athleticism and quickness was one of the things that came into the model as being a good predictor. And the other one was I think what do they call it, leadership and intangibles.
Yeah.
Those are two separate, but they're very, you don't get many guys who they rate as having great leadership but poor intangibles. So
that's interesting. That's something that makes me think about another aspect of the value that models can bring. I talked about this a little bit with Cole Zwicker, who I had on a couple episodes ago, and he talked about there's this thing that scouts can kind of fall into where your analysis gets a little checkboxy, like, does this guy have this, can he do this, he can't do that, he can't do this, and he can get a little binary. And like, maybe the best scouts can think about it in like one or two shades of gray, right? They can give like a little bit of gradient to a certain attribute, but statistics, obviously, they can do that very well, right? Like, we have decimal places for a reason, right? Like, there's gradient there. So that's interesting that you say that balancing athleticism and skill development is like one of the central questions in draft analysis. And while models obviously are leaning toward kind of the skill stuff because they're just looking at box score, and oftentimes in the NCAA it can be maybe a little bit more indicative of skill. Also in there is athleticism, right? Like for every, right. what's like a recent, gosh, I'm going to butcher this so bad and I don't even have a reference or like anyone who actually did it. I'm blanking so hard. But somebody recently did a study about wingspan and defensive, what's ESPN's RPM?
RPM?
Thing. Yeah, yeah. They're yeah.
The defensive RPM?
Yeah, there you go. So they like for every inch that your wingspan added or whatever, you went up, you know, so many, you know, so much in your DRPM. And I thought that was really, really interesting that the correlation was actually, and it was pretty strong of a correlation. So athleticism, all that stuff does matter. Like sometimes I feel like right now the scouting community is swinging so far to the skill because of the finals that we just saw, right? Smaller, right. skiller, more skilled perimeter players seem to be more valuable. Well, in the NBA, obviously, like there's probably like some cutoffs for athleticism that maybe Kyle Anderson, slow-mo, right? Maybe he didn't reach some of these cutoffs to be able to translate the skill that he has, which he obviously still has, which is the maybe the one thing that's allowing him to get any minutes at all. But yeah, that's a really interesting kind of thing. I don't know if there are any other models or not necessarily models, but just kind of exploratory things that you or maybe anyone else that you know have kind of gone into that question to try to flesh that out a little more.
Yeah, a lot of guys try and use, you know, height or wingspan, but the one that I did with the ratings, there's just not a lot of, you know, sometimes we'll use standing vertical as a stand-in for athleticism, and that has, it's like one of those variables that sometimes it shows up, sometimes it doesn't, but it's not changing a lot. And of course you don't have that on
everybody, all the right? players. So not everybody goes to the combine, right? Yeah.
So it doesn't, but you know, one kind of analogy that I like to use is, I'll try and do this quickly because so like if you're doing a real estate model, said I'm going to do luxury condos and you say, well, I don't really need to do a model for all of Metro Boston for the luxury condos because they're all located in like three different neighborhoods. So you do that model, location is actually not going to be a big factor because they're all in very similar locations. Mm-hmm. And that's fine and that's good. And it'll, but what you can't do then is take that luxury condo model and apply it to condos that are way out in the suburbs or whatever, because you're missing now that location factor.
Right.
And so that's the thing with like athleticism is that, you know, you're kind of testing this on guys who for the most part are all in that same, within that same neighborhood of athleticism. So it looks like it's less of a factor than it is.
I see.
You know, so you're kind of restricting that range. The range that you're testing on isn't big enough for it to make a difference, and it might hide the variable a little bit when somebody who's actually outside of that range shows up in the model.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if there are other statistics that you've seen that work that way, even box score statistics.
Yeah. So when you know I did that thing on converting 3-point shooting.
Oh, right. Yeah. Let's get to that. Cause I reference that all the time. So thank you, by the way.
Sure. So like, you know, if you do the model on just guys who have taken a lot of 3-point shots, in their NCAA career, then the frequency of shooting doesn't really matter. And again, that's fine if you're only going to apply it to other sort of elite shooters. Mm-hmm. But if you use a wider range, what you find is that it's pretty indicative if the guy only takes like 1 3-pointer a game, doesn't matter if he's average, he's got a 40% average, you know, that's a pretty good indicator that he's only taking one, right. Either shot's too slow or his coach doesn't trust him, or he doesn't have the confidence in it, you know. So, you know, how you set up the model and what you kind of filter out affects the weight of those variables.
Yeah, it's interesting. So that's, the rate, there's a lot wrapped up in just like the rate itself, not necessarily the percentage.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's got the green light from his coach. He's got a quick enough release to get it off. He's got the confidence to shoot it. He's not passing that shot up, you know, so, you know,
and also if you're taking a high volume, probably a lot of those are more difficult shots, right? Like, or at least a higher percentage of those are more difficult shots. So then at the NBA level, you know, maybe that just speaks to he's a better shooter. Anyway, yeah, sorry, continue.
Yeah, so that's, I think, another good example of, you know, that restriction of range affects how the variable acts in the model. And so if you're only interested in comparing elite shooters, you can restrict. Say, I only want guys who've taken 200 shots, 200 or 250, at least threes or whatever, and that's fine. But then you can't apply that to some power forward who took like 30 threes.
Right.
You know, and say, oh, well, he shot 40% on him, but he only took 30. So there's something going on there.
Right.
He's not the same thing as the elite shooters.
Right. So recently on your blog, you did like a little bit extra on that shooting projections article that you did for Nylon Calculus. And you looked kind of back and you applied it and kind of were looking at how right you were, you know. And you talked about like the error for these two models that you use that are pretty similar in their results. I don't know exactly like how, you know, everything behind the scenes, but the error was about 3%, right? I started thinking about like how much does that like really matter as an NBA shooter? Because we talk about so much, hey, you know, let's say like if I really want to look on the high side and I think Josh Jackson, if I'm trying to make an argument for him, let's say, and I say, yeah, I think he could be like a 34, maybe 35% 3-point shooter. And we know that like, for some reason in the media, now like 35% is the cutoff. Like if you can shoot 35%, then you're good. If you're below that, then you're bad. Right. So I wonder if maybe you have done it with like the distance data, like the closest defender data from the NBA stats stuff, or maybe like old Sport 2 data when it was available in 2014. If you have looked at like how much the defense respects you, like if that matters, does it correlate well with how well you actually shoot or maybe not, like maybe, you know, it's reputation or something like that. And obviously reputation and how well you shoot are very correlated, but I wonder how much, like if I'm a 33% shooter, like if Josh Jackson turns out to be a 33% 3-point shooter, is that actually different than being a 36% 3-point shooter? If no one thinks he can shoot, then maybe it doesn't matter.
Right. I think that it does, and but I have not done that. So I know that there was a study sort of floating around about NBA gravity, and like some of the guys at ESPN would reference this NBA gravity, but I never actually saw the study and what went into it. But I do know that, you know, there was guys who shot well tended to have a better gravity, but then there was some weird thing that and this was, you know, D-Wade a couple years ago, that he had gravity even though...
he's never shot well. Yeah, interesting.
He's never shot well. For some reason, people were guarding him, and then there's like, oh, was it because he's so good at back cuts, or is it just because he's D-Wade? Well, we don't... But yeah, so...
I'll have to try to dig that up. That's interesting.
Yes. I think Tom Haverstow had been the one who wrote about it, but I could be misremembering that.
Yeah, I wonder if it actually probably correlates closer to like your previous years, right? Than like the current one or whatever. Anyway, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I've heard, you know, anecdotally people say, oh, if I hit my first three, then they're guarding me, and then
it's a game by game kind of thing. Yeah,
you know. And I do know that when they did a study on the hot hand that was at Sloan, they did talk about if guys make a couple shots that the defender will guard them closer.
Right.
But then the countervailing was that guys who make a couple shots will then take more difficult shots.
So it plays into the defense's favor anyway, like in both ways. That's interesting.
Yeah, so they will defend him more, so he will have more gravity, but then he's also more likely to take a shot anyway, even if he's being defended.
That's so interesting. All right, we are up against the wall here, and I want to get to just a little bit the question of upside. Drafting, whether you should draft for upside or whether you should draft for like the median outcome or maybe the 75th percentile outcome or whatever it is. We've talked about this a lot on my podcast, specifically with Mark Whittington. Go back and listen to that one. Really, really interesting episode. He's a smart and cool guy. And then more recently, we touched on it a little bit with Jay-Z, Maslish. But you kind of mentioned that you have some thoughts on this. So the floor is yours. Tell us what you know.
Well, you know, you always said that the conundrum. Well, one is I think that they're pretty closely related, but there is some separation in terms of median outcome and upside outcome. So, you know, I did two separate models. One is kind of predicting, is this guy going to be in the top 10% in the NBA or so? Or is he going to fall out of the NBA? And then this was one where, as much as I was interested in the prediction, I was also more interested really in the variables, which variables acted differently in these two different models, you know. So it gets back to our original conversation. And so kind of the interesting thing on that, if I can remember exactly what it was. So having good box score stats overall was a great indicator of being a star. But, you know, when you separate them out, scoring was very important. And going and being young. So, which are not, none of those are big surprises. But then on the flip side of basically sticking in the NBA, so not so much median outcome, but floor, steals, like if a guy has had steals, he would stay in the NBA, or and conversely, if he didn't have steals. And then the risky, that high school rating came into that, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. So those guys had high floors. So like when I applied this model last year, the guy with the smallest range of outcomes was Jaylen Brown.
Interesting. Gosh, I wish you had told me that at the time, Andrew.
He had virtually no chance. I mean, but you know, these are just for this model, but the model gave him very low likelihood of being a star because he had performed so poorly at Cal.
Yeah.
And then, but you know, he was a pretty young player, had been a top high school recruit. I think his steal stats were okay. He had a really low chance of being a complete bust. So he had like the least variance in his outcomes. So guys who kind of have more variance are guys who are not super young, you know, are maybe sophomores or juniors, but have really great box score stats, and with some scoring in there. It could be that that's just fool's gold, or it could be that, you know, he's really more than what the scouts think, sort of.
Interesting. So how do you interpret that? Like, what do you think that might mean? Like, a few theories.
One thing that there's a little bit of a selection thing with the guys who were top star recruits coming out of high school are going to get a lot of chances.
Oh, right. Yeah,
they're going to keep going to the well. Like, I mean, Beasley's still in the league, you know, and he was one of my model's biggest misses, sort of in sample. But, you know, he keeps coming back. so that's one that's sort of an interpretive, you know, that maybe the model's getting fooled because these guys just keep getting chances and eventually they turn into something okay. But I think that the ones that are kind of interesting is, you know, really like these guys who put up big numbers, they don't go out as freshmen. Those are guys who end up with like a really high, and we're not highly recruited, they end up with a pretty high variance because those numbers could just be, like I said, kind of a fool's gold, or really that guy could turn into something special. So kind of, you know, if you're later in the draft, you know, that kind of indicates if you're going to roll the dice, just go for a guy who's putting up big numbers and see what happens.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, there are three guys that come to mind right away that listeners of the podcast will know, and maybe you know these guys. I don't know. D'Anthony Melton out of USC. I love this guy. Great, like, feel, like, and it shows up in the steal percentage and block percentage for a point guard. He's, like, he's really good. His anticipation on defense is awesome. And Bruce Brown out of Miami, and then McCall Bridges out of Villanova. Seems to be like the perfect 3-and-D role player. Although he's a little slight, but those guys are all really interesting guys that I had definitely like lottery picks, all three of them, and they all chose to go back. Of course, Bruce is a little older. Bridges is also a little, like, he's going into what, his junior season, and Melton's super, super young and going to be a sophomore next year. But I wonder, fire up your model and tell me what they say, even though I know that there's like a lot of variance in that. So I don't know how much error there is, but fire those up and get back to me and tell me how Melton's going to do. Cause
I know I had, Bridges in there, at one time and I took it out. And I remember him being highly rated, by the model. And I was surprised that he went back. There was another guy who went back, that I was really surprised with, and it was going to be
Miles Bridges probably.
Bridges and who was the other one? There was another guy,
Williams out of Texas A&M. Yeah.
Yeah. I was really surprised he went back because the model was like had him top five or so.
Yeah, yeah. His block percentage is like through the roof. Yeah, and a lot of models love that stuff. So yeah.
I was surprised that I can fire it up and see if. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. But again, with the you know, the other thing with the ceiling versus median outcome is you know, it is a little bit easier to predict the median outcome, and so you always get into this conundrum of, you know, what's the trade-off of, like, you know, this is the most important thing, but I have really a hard time predicting, like, true shooting percentage is something that is almost, I've never had any luck in actually predicting true shooting percentage. Once you get, so you think, oh well, efficiency's important, but it doesn't really translate well. So if you can't predict it, how much, you can't really give that much weight to it.
Yeah. So have you ever tried to take some of these guys that really, really outperform, you know, their median outcome or their model, and just, I know it's probably a small sample size, and there's some other thing, like statistical violations, like why you should never do this, but just take that subsection of your population and try to just model that. Like, try to like find any patterns in guys that really, really kind of outstrip that and show like a realization of, you know, this theoretical upside that we can, you know, you could give anybody, but for some reason these guys reached it, or at least, you know, maybe that's like a too strong of an interpretation of what we're seeing, but maybe there's another reason. Maybe that is their median outcome. I don't know.
Right.
You know, obviously, like, some of these top guys, like LeBron's median outcome is really, really close to like this, you know, super, super great player, obviously. So, you know, that's not the guy we're talking about, but somebody who was kind of average in your model, but really, really outstripped that. Have you ever tried to take those guys and try to find any, you know, predictive thing in that way?
Yeah, no, I haven't ever tried. Yeah, there's a little bit dicey statistically because you're biasing your sample. But you know, one thing I did notice, I did one thing a while ago on like teams, because there aren't that many teams where you can really. I just looked at guys who are like, well, you've had a GM who's been there basically for the life of my model, like the Celtics, the Spurs, I think my in Miami. The only one I found is like the Spurs pick great players, like even though they've been like average of 25th or 27th place, you know, something like that, right. In the first round, they were getting like top 15 talent on average, at least according to the model. And then they were also outperforming what the model thought they were going to do.
Right. So, interesting.
So, whereas the Celtics were almost exactly average. But Ainge had made so many picks over that time that he basically was just kind of a volume picker. So,
right, which is, yeah, that's... Drafting well is super hard. There's so much randomness. All right.
Yeah, so he just gave himself as many opportunities as possible.
Which is probably just... So, like, even if he is a good drafter, yeah, it might just average down to, like, whatever... You know, that player was going to be. Maybe at that point he doesn't have a ton of... I don't know. Interesting. All right. Or, no, actually, it'd probably be the other way around, right? Since he has a lot of volume, it probably reflects more about his true ability as an evaluator.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's maybe it is a more of a different strategy. You know, if you're getting all these picks through, you know, whatever deals, that's kind of the Patriots thing, right, in the NFL, where they would... before I think people finally figured out that... how hard it is to draft the NFL, they'd say, oh yeah, we'll give you one R pick for 2 years. But then when people realize that those two picks are actually more valuable, because even though they're later, because there's so much randomness in the NFL draft.
Interesting. All right, Andrew, you have been exceedingly interesting. Interesting is the right adjective to use here.
I hope so.
We got deep into the weeds on this one. listeners, probably I'll tell them at the beginning to get like their statistical dictionary out so they can be researching this stuff as you're talking about it. Where can they find your model, your predictions, all that kind of stuff? Maybe just give your Twitter and then your blog kind of a shout out, and then maybe some stuff on Nylon Calculus, something like that.
Sure. It's at Counting Baskets is my Twitter handle. And my blog is countingbaskets.typepad.com. And then we've got quite a bit of stuff that I put on at fan-sided Nylon Calculus, or just Nylon Calculus. So yeah.
Yeah, I recommend checking out like anything Andrew puts up. Read that thing immediately. If it's not... some like prescient crystal ball type thing, at least it will make you think in a very interesting way. Consider some of your own priors as an evaluator. And Andrew, I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks for doing it, man.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sean.